So I'm kind of I'm gonna I just wrote like I basically I wrote over 12,000 words for the Sync Book 2, which I narrowed down the night before last to 7,000. But the whole final sequence is all like going into Rosemary's Baby and The Shining, and I had to cut that out because I couldn't include everything, and I didn't want the whole thing just to be about that. So it's kind of a bummer I have all this information. I'm gonna make it another book though, but whatever. I mentioned that. But Charles Manson, fucking, oh boy,
He's the Blackbird, right? Manson's the Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
totally, dude. Like Manson is okay. So he's in the not just the prison, but actually the section of the prison that was it's basically been disclosed at this point that they were doing all this MK Ultra experimentation with inmates. He was there, like in the block, like during the time in which that was taking place, and then was released. Like I'm not saying that that happened, but if there ever was a case for a strong possibility, it's right there. And so that gets really strange too. Like you mentioned Chuck Berry, like Chuck Berry, like fucking, I mean, in his autobiography is expressing that he was a hitman for the CIA. It's kind of weird to think about this. I can't help but consider that, like, first of all, like The Shining is written for Joe y Young King or Joe King, which is funny. It sounds like joking, but Stephen King's son, who died at a young age and is dedicated to him, who shines on, which is a John Lennon reference, which is where the name The Shining comes from, is from Instant Karma. But then you have who is Joseph's father in the Bible, but Jacob. And you have Jacob's vision with Jacob's ladder and all that. And then throughout The Shining, the song that gets repeated when he goes into room 237, it happens to be Jacob's dream, which is a reference to Jacob's ladder. And I can't help but make this like parallel between like basically Helter Skelter, the slide of Helter Skelter, which is a spiral slide that you go up to the top of, and then you climb steps to go up, and then you slide down, and you climb steps to go up, and then you slide down. It's like this idea of like I was considering the whole 60s as like this wave, that people talk about, that there's this thing taking place. We're all going towards this thing where like the children on Houses of the Holy or something, like Childhood's End, like climbing towards the source, and then everything just like collapses. And so I think of that also of like I got to get off of this merry-go-round. Like it expresses it pretty poignantly. It's like a total like you're just going and you feel like you're going somewhere, but you're not, or at least you're slowly progressing or something, like two steps forward and one step back or something. I don't know. I was just going as in circles myself with that all those ideas, kind of.
Jack Nicholson's character in Chinatown is named Jake.
Well, there
So
you
we're
go.
back to Polanski.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah.
Now, the Blackbird Manson's like, he heard the album, he goes, that's about the coming race war. It's an apocalypse that's going to happen. We're going to chill out, me and the family. We're going to hide out. The blacks are going to rise up. They're going to kill all the whites. And when they accomplish that, they're not going to know what the fuck to do. So me and the family are going to come out of our hidey hole, and then we will run the show, right? That was Manson's whole spiel in a
Right.
nutshell. Well,
Right.
okay. Now again, the sources, it's bizarre. McCartney on the Wikipedia page says he wrote Blackbird somewhat inspired by racial tension. And he did identify the Blackbird with black people and their ascension. So that's fucked up. Because I don't know how explicit Blackbird or how McCartney was at that time. So,
No.
I'm just saying that Manson, I mean, he's a whack job, but, he wasn't 100% off in this
It's
stuff.
Bluebird. So, like, he did Blackbird. He also did Bluebird. Project Bluebird is MK Ultra.
Well,
That's the
okay.
only name. MK Ultra is Project Bluebird. So you know the Paul McCartney song Bird?
Yeah, I'm a blue bird.
I'm a blue bird. Yeah.
I'm just saying, that's weird.
And the other thing about Manson, and I don't know if this is just obvious, but I mean, isn't that what Atlas Shrugged is all about? That a select few hide out, wait for everybody to tear the world to pieces, and then the select few come out and rebuild everything, or they're the leaders.
Right.
Well, I don't...
It's also the basic plot of The Shining.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Totally. It's built on an Indian burial ground. We had to ward off several Indian attacks. You know? It's like... Oh, what was I just going to say? Whatever.
Well, Blackbird is a song about animals, and then it goes right into piggies, and then right into Rocky Raccoon. It's odd that those three animal songs are all tied together. I was wondering if anyone had any take on that. I mean, you have a McCartney song, you have a Harrison song, and then...
another McCartney song.
Another McCartney song.
Piggy's song is weird. It's like, I mean, obviously, like, it's not a very kosher song. The pigs are eating, they're cannibals, and they're eating each other. I mean, they're there to eat the fucking bacon.
And don't they talk about the forks and knives?
Yeah.
And Rosemary LaBianca was the one with the forks and knives stuck into her?
Right. And then, oh, that's fucked up.
Right?
And so you, on the door of the Manson family home, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, All Good Children Go to Heaven. The song is called The End, off of Abbey Road. But that was written on the door before Abbey Road was ever released. Meaning that some fucking Beatles were hanging out with Manson. But a lot of people were hanging out with Manson. Everybody went there for their acid, which was Tavistock acid, which was the introduction of Orange Sunshine, where the chemical was completely removed. It's like, you know, closer to moving towards like FTP direction. You have LSD-6 and all of these different versions. But everyone who committed those murders was on the first real shift from what they were used to as pure acid. Which was produced by the CIA, which is pretty far out, because this is actually Manson family members talk about this. They're like, this acid was like unlike anything anybody had had. Where was he getting it? And he was most likely getting it directly from Tavistock. These people had connects in, through Stanford University, which was into the CIA. It's kind of crazy.
Well, it doesn't have to. It has, you know... Whatever. People in the CIA, not the CIA. Right?
What's that?
You can say...
MK Ultra, a lot of people are involved. But, I mean, Dr. Green and stuff, he was doing more the darker side of what took place, you know? I hate the men who stare at goats for certain reasons, and I love it for certain other reasons. One of the reasons I hate it is because it just feels like they're downplaying what actually took place. You have these people fucking drilling holes in people's heads, keeping them in a coma for months on end, just like unbelievable shit. And then children, you know, people, all these people went before a board of what the presidential board, basically talking about seeing 300 children that are going through
fucked up
shit you could imagine. And this is all to a degree been declassified. They're like, yeah, we got all these children. And so then when you look at the time frame, you're like, okay, so you have hundreds of children at least in America that were experimented with and then basically had memories repressed. And then to say that there was no success is possible. But I feel like that's like that general assumption that these people had, like when they first got found out and they went before the committee, they like made a whole joke out of it and they had to recall them later because nobody took it seriously. They're like, oh yeah, we were just fooling around with this and that. Like they just made a humorous thing out of it. They're like, wait a minute. No, you guys are doing fucked up shit. It was
actually, there's a joke. If you, are any of you familiar with Jeannie, She Who Remembers? She was referenced recently in the sort of the Terrence McKenna debunking piece. Anyway, there were interviews that she conducted with people who had like at things. There were people who showed up there thinking that they were the only ones who had sort of weird memories, adult people. And there were these groups that formed of people who were reclaiming their memories together because they realized they all remembered the same room and the same spinning table and the same basic things that they had just thought were their own tripped out memories, and everyone in their life had just sort of treated them like they were crazy about. I don't know. It's an interesting, I know these hearings took place, like, I'm thinking like middle of Clinton time. And it all came out because they were actually doing a hearings on nuclear. It was supposed to be bringing out information about nuclear experiments or radiation experiments. And that sort of touched on the MKUltra thing. And then that all came out in those hearings. Very interesting how that was released in a way that sure looks like a total fuck up. Mm-hmm. Like the information wants to get out. Like you can't keep the genie in the bottle. Or it was, you know, masterfully done to look that way.
Mm-hmm. Jesus, isn't LaBianca mean white?
Yeah.
So I call this whole sink Rosemary's White Baby. So Rosemary LaBianca would be Rosemary the White, wouldn't it?
Yep.
So I don't know. That's a little stinky, sinky. That's fucked up.
So as if we're following the movie, you know, from we're about to get to the part of "Don't Pass Me By."
A quick note about Rocky Raccoon, and then we'll go. Yeah. Did you read that the original title for Rocky Raccoon was Rocky Sassoon? Right, so I read this shit and I go, I wonder how that's gonna pop up. When is that gonna have meaning? So I start talking to my sister about Rosemary's Baby and syncing it with the White Album, not really going in depth, just telling her the shit I was watching. And she just offhand mentions the thing about Vidal Sassoon creating the pixie haircut for Mia Farrow for that film.
Well, not just that, but she references it twice. She says his name in it.
Oh, she does. Because see, I've watched it the last two times without subtitles and just listening to the music with the images. So she references it.
I just for the first time watched it with sound today because I knew we were going to have this call. And yeah, she actually comes in. He says, oh, that's horrible. She says, oh, it's Vidal Sassoon. And then later on at the party sequence, someone says something about it. She says, it's Vidal Sassoon.
And I think it's just such a beautiful mirror image of what the whole Beatles and their long hair, and now this is a Manhattanite with her short hair, you know, that it's quite shocking, or people thought of it as something, a pixie haircut by this guy. He invented it. That
wasn't there a famous hairdresser involved in the Manson killings?
The last great straight hairdresser, they said.
The guy that Warren Beatty's character in Shampoo was based on.
Yeah.
One of, what is his name?
Tchaikovsky or something?
No. I'm going to do some search here. I'm going to mute myself.
But I just find that, you know, there's a very obvious shift when she makes her, like a coming out party for her at that scene in her apartment. And that, you know, the Catholic girl has now become a city girl. And
wait a minute. Oh, Rocky coming from a little town in Minnesota rather than the album's versions, Black Mountain Hills and Out Dakota?
Really?
Dakota? Okay.
That's pretty weird.
His name, the hairdresser's name was Jay Sebring.
Oh, and you know what's weird about him is that he was going out with the woman, Sharon Tate lookalike that Polanski eventually hooks up with. And he looks like Polanski.
And he dated Sharon Tate, I think, before Polanski hooked up with her.
Yeah. So there are a lot of like doppelgangers having gangbangs, you know, together here. So. Hmm.
And now this brings it back to 68 again, and why I've always, like, I don't know if you guys have are fans, but I think that Shampoo is one of my favorite films. I've never done a sync film with it, because I think it's a really interesting sync film in itself, is that it was made in 1975, but it all takes place 1968 again. The night of Nixon's election or inauguration in LA. And that would have been right pre Manson, like the time when Manson would have been hanging out at those parties. Mm. And so, they're documenting that LA party, those LA parties with, you know, and with Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds is playing in the party sequence in it. It's one of the early Beatles, like, you know, things, movies that was able to license a Beatles song. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I find it weird. Like, Shine On, You Crazy Diamond. Like, I do a sync with The Shining, where I started out with Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here. And then I go into Jim Morrison's An American Prayer, which was made after his death, recorded on December 8th, which is the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, the day John Lennon died. And then I go from that to the album 13, which was the only compilation album ever produced while Jim Morrison was alive. And I go from that to just playing the end. And it ends like right at the end, like in this really fucking bizarre way. But like that was like a, it's weird. Like everything kind of leads on to the next thing. But I find it interesting, like Shine On, You Crazy Diamond, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. And you have Pink Floyd's response to the Beatles with Syd Barrett in Saucer Full of Secrets, when he goes, "Then revealed in flowing robes was Lucy in the Sky." It's obviously, like, this is an example of, like, where you're like, come on, dude, we know, like, he's like, oh yeah, my son drew a picture of a thing, and he said, yeah, this is Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Like, it had nothing to do with LSD. Like, there's a number of outright lies that seem like, why, like, with the Beatles, like, tons of examples, like Yoko Ono saying she had never known the Beatles before this whole thing where she met John. Meanwhile, it turns out that Paul McCartney was like the organizer for the fucking art show that John met her at. Like, he was the one in charge of the fucking thing in the first place by a Swadom, like a...
You know, that one I could totally see someone being like, she's an older art. It's like, if you were having something that was organized by Justin Bieber, would you give, you know, you're like, you're kind of aware, like, you're
no
aware
way.
Of
no
the
way.
Beatles.
Totally different. What? There's three channels. I mean, if she even graced, was in front of a TV for 30 minutes.
Did she say she'd never heard of the Beatles? Or did she say that she never paid any attention to them?
There's a big... paid attention to them, but meanwhile she never mentions that, like, the coordinator of her art show is Paul McCartney.
Well, it's not like he was putting on an art show when he was there. McCartney was a funder of a ton of stuff.
Right. No, I can appreciate what you're saying. Yeah, it's like, it's a thing where it's like she doesn't mention it. Like, it's like kind of like, I don't know, it feels like slightly manipulative in a way.
No, I mean,
or it's like, I mean, saying I've heard of Seinfeld, but, you know, I never watched it.
Right, that's just like one example. There's like a lot of examples with the Beatles where there's like a degree of like elusiveness or dishonesty or like manipulation, and usually it's about shit that doesn't seem that important. It's like, why would they not say that? Like, but I know over time I've come across a number of examples of where I'm like, wow, that has actually
turned out. I was wearing shoes because it was hot. That whole,
well, I mean, Lennon was always changed. Like,
that's the whole Paul is dead thing is a whole nother. That's just,
yeah,
that's like 12 hours right there just to talk about it.
Right.
bringing it back to the White Album, the White Album's full of songs that are one, like Maharishi, Sexy Sadie was originally Maharishi.
Right.
You know, well, that, I guess, caught,
obviously the Yamaha sign in the commercial that her husband's on in Rosemary's Baby, when he walks up and it's the whole thing and it says Maha because it's the bottom right. Yamaha. I love that.
Yeah, that's gorgeous.
And then you have Holy Mountain, right? Like I said, produced by John Lennon. And it's actually the sequence, if you watch it with Hollywood, where it's the closing sequence of Count to Six and Die, which is a reference to a revolver. John Lennon's killed with a revolver. They do fucking revolver. It's just like too perfect. It's also, okay, so you have this group of people all who get basically mass murdered in Holy Mountain. And the head at the front has a fucking, has Maharishi on his head, an image of Maharishi, like, and he's leading the people who all end up dying. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And then they have, like, they use, like, fruit and stuff to imitate, like, the mass, like, super fucking weird. And then they take out a baby out of a person as a watermelon and then crush the watermelon under their foot and all that shit. Like, what the fuck? Like, the shit that's communicated with Holy Mountain, it's like, what is it?
And then you get the Sexy Sadie, you get, that's the song that Jodie Foster identifies herself with in The Accused.
Right.
With, and she's, of course, you know, Mark David Chapman, ripoff man, Hinckley, you know, these sort of interchangeable doubles of each other, like fat glasses wearing, like Salinger freaks shooting famous people.
And don't you identify
Jay Salinger, Jay Sebring?
Yeah.
Don't you identify all the songs with different female names as Rosemary in the movie going through all these different changes and taking on different shades of her new identity? Because everyone around her is staying exactly the same. You start off with Dear Prudence, and then you go into Wild Honey Pie, and then Martha, and then Blackbird and Julia. I mean, the album seems to follow a progression of her dissension or ascension into this new world that she's in. And I don't know.
You see that kind of like breakdown of like female, or the interchangeability of female identity is also an Eyes Wide Shut. Like with...
Mm-hmm, which is Alice, right? You have Alice,
but like all the female characters all blend, they all look like each other, and like the by the time you get to the orgy, they're just like swapping out the woman like every shot, like it's a different woman.
Alice with Bungalow Bill, what did you kill?
Right, exactly.
Back in the Roadhouse, we got some bungalows.
Did you guys catch that the daughter in Eyes Wide Shut is named Helena? Who's there studying at the beginning with the, it's like Christmas, it's got like the Christmas tree up and everything, but Helena is the name of the mother, or the teacher, excuse me, in Alice in Wonderland, and then obviously the daughter's name is Alice, and then here the mother's name is Alice, and her daughter is Helena, sitting there studying, just like at the beginning of Alice in Wonderland. I don't know, that's something.
Yeah, and if you see Disney's Peter Pan anytime soon, you'll fall off your chair, because it's
right.
Like every movie we're talking about is all right there too.
Completely, I couldn't agree more. And then you have the vampire symbolism all over the place, connecting us right into Batman and all the sync around that. Because I mean, the Lost Boys, you know, I mean, that's like there's Peter Pan, like. You have, he's obviously Pan, right? But then you have, he's playing the fucking Pan pipes. But then Pan literally translates as the feeder, you know? And it's this whole, like, idea of, like, that the vampire, like, as Draco or whatever is, like, basically, it's a play on, I mean, the actual guy, Dracula, the Count Dracula, drank people's blood, drank his enemy's blood or whatever, you know? But as a sacrament and a play on Christianity, it was his interpretation of Christianity, which is very similar to the ideas in Rosemary's Baby, where you have this twist on the Catholic idea. But it's also showing, like, at the depths of Catholicism, what you're actually dealing with if you follow the extent, if you extend it through. In the same way, like, Alice in Wonderland is a satire on algebra and the emerging, I mean, he was a mathematician, and he's doing a satire on how ridiculous it is if you follow it to its end. And so these things are the same way with Christianity. They're like, okay, what does this actually look like if you follow this logic through to the end?
Absolutely.
Rosemary's Baby and fucking, like, you know, the epitome, basically, of what's wrong with it. Like, yeah, you take a scapegoat, the philosophy of a scapegoat, and, like, actually, like, apply what that means energetically, like, what you end up with, you know?
Oh, you end up exiled like Polanski was.
Yeah.
I mean, Polanski was amazing because he, like, he just got eaten alive by Sink. Like, his movies and his life synced up in so many ways. It was just... like he had nowhere to go. He ended up, you know, he ended up in the prison he was trying to escape from his whole life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what was that documentary you were referencing, John?
Yeah, I just watched it. It's called Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired, and it's a documentary basically about the case against him. But Bugliosi uses Sink to connect the Beatles to Manson, to the Bus Manson, the prosecuting attorney in the Polanski case uses Sink to show that he has prior desire to rape this young girl, because like he's like in every single one of his movies there's a woman threatened above water, and so like
that was part of his defense.
Yeah. Polanski raped this girl in a jacuzzi. So he was like, this is just part of his art. You know, like it's in, you know, in his innermost makeup is like the desire to recreate these scenes of a man, of a corrupt man, like torturing a young woman above water.
That's crazy if they allowed that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was Hollywood.
Right.
I mean, the whole thing was everyone here is pretty aware that, you know, life's the stage.
So, okay, so the Don't Pass Me By, which is where we kind of left off, that's where, that's the first Ringo Starr solo composition, right? That's his song. That's the one he wrote by himself. And I guess it had been around for a couple of years before they decided to use it for the White Album. But it has the line in there, you were in a car crash and you lost your hair. So that's them feeding back into the whole Paul is dead again, correct?
They play with that a ton. And so the thing is, even if it's not real, they're loving it, you know?
But also, Rosemary loses her hair.
That's right. Yeah, everything. And so, like, and there's a lot of superficial things throughout it. Like, they mention, like, pour yourself a glass of wine, and then there you have the wine at the table. The smoking of the cigarette. They're, like, I don't know. There's, like, one point where they say the statement about the cigarette, and then, boom, they're right there smoking a cigarette.
When they say, "And I'm so tired, wonder should I get up and fix myself a drink?" And Ruth Gordon gets up from the table immediately to go get a drink.
That's actually what I was referring to. I just can't.
Oh, yeah.
Lyrical content. So yeah,
we were thinking and sinking.
No.
Now I have a question for all of you, because I remember when I watched this film when I was a kid, you know, 18, 19, whatever, when I first saw this film, the scene on the boat, I always remembered it as having John F. Kennedy in it. And having watched it now 25 or more times, he's actually not in it. But I spoke with Alan, our friend Alan Abadesa Green, and he said that he had the same memory as well from when he was a kid. Like what he remembers from the film, and he probably saw it, I guess he saw it younger, what he remembers is only that psychedelic sequence. And he remembered it as being very Kennedy, like having something about to do with Kennedy too. And that was and actually, it can't have been 18 or 19 for me, because it was pre sort of any awareness of how this was all connected.
Well, so Kennedy in the media is always associated with boats. He's a war hero, associated with boats. Like,
right, but Roman.
It's always on Nantucket, you know, he's a sailor, blah, blah. It's part of his whole image.
He had dinner with one of the Kennedys before the night before they died. He had the Last Supper with them.
No, that's what, yeah, Alan was telling me that Polanski had dinner with. Polanski and Sharon Tate had dinner with Robert Kennedy.
Yeah, Robert Kennedy, yeah.
Well, there you have your whole Mia Prudence kind of mirror action going on, you know? Maybe.
Yeah, in this, this Polanski documentary, like, there's footage with him. He's like a, you know, a socialite, a London swinger. So he, there's pictures, footage of him with basically every rock star you can think
Who's
of.
This?
Polanski is connect, personally has a, is on a first name basis with like everyone you can think of.
Well, because now I'm thinking about John and Robert. Robert was far more serious than his brother, correct? He wasn't, I mean, he might have had some, in some ways, if you had to lean one way or the other, I would imagine that Bobby would probably look at his brother at times and go, what the fuck are you doing? You know?
Wait, who are you talking with? I lost you.
Okay, so I was trying to connect Mia Farrow.
Oh, John and Bob. Okay, John and Bob. Okay, I
so
like John Lennon and Bobby who? Oh, John Kennedy.
Well, that's the thing.
Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy. JFK and RFK.
Either way, they're the same John. Like, it's like it's a whole King Kill phenomenon. Yeah. Like, it's just such a like classic archetypal symbolism just being repeated. That's why with Holy Wood, you look at the lyrical content over and again, the president is dead, let us pray. Like, basically, there's this whole, like, pointing out at how it is that we feed off of it in the same way. We do this thing. We put someone on the pedestal, and then we like, chew on their bones, you know? It's fucked
up.
Well,
I mean, it's pretty interesting. So I've been sort of crafting a little timeline. And this connects it to the, and while we're in the Kennedy and on the boats, why not get to the Sinatra part? Because the reason Mia Farrow's even in the movie is because of the celebrity that she gained from marrying Frank Sinatra. And that was on July 19th, 1966. Before that, she was the girl from Peyton Place, a TV soap opera. But she marries Sinatra in Vegas in July of 66. John meets Yoko in November 9th, 1966. Brian Epstein and Brian Epstein dies in August of 67, when they're going to see the Beatles are going to see the Maharishi. So then filming on Rosemary's Baby begins that September through January. And during the shooting, Mia Farrow is divorced by Sinatra by mail. Then in February, now she's a star, and in February, she and her sister go to Marrakesh with the Beatles. This is February of 68. So Polanski's editing Rosemary's Baby. The Beatles are in Marrakesh with Mia Farrow. Then on the 21st, November 21st, then in June of 68, the film comes out. June, I think, 6th of 1968, the Rosemary's Baby comes out. And then let's stop there because I could just keep going. But
and it's like the same week that the Tate murders happen that's fucking Woodstock.
Well, no, that okay. So then, okay, to do that, then we have to. You're jumping because that's jumping to 69.
Way forward. It's just a little fact that I can't help but be like, whoa.
Well, but okay. So this is, but we can tie it. So let me tie it this way. So then, on November 21st, 1968, Yoko Ono suffers her miscarriage. The next day, November 22nd, 1968, the White Album was released. 8.5 months later, Sharon Tate is murdered.
Oh, so
while pregnant,
right at the time of her inception.
Yes.
Weird.
Yeah, that's fucked up.
Yeah, when something dies, something else begins. Wow, that's crazy.
Good night. Oh God, it's so. What's the Oh man, it's just yeah. Whew.
So I'm like going off on all this stuff, and I had to bring it up to my rabbi because I study Kabbalah with this teacher, and I'm telling him this stuff, and he starts talking about how white the shoes were of this guy who was dating one of the Golden Girls or something. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he is like talking about basically being at Manson's home and seeing how white this guy's shoes were. And that basically he hung out with Charles Manson And I was like, you hung out with Charles Manson? He was like, everyone hung out with Charles Manson. I mean, he lived there. So he was just like, you know, he was always like, you had anybody could just show up and everyone went to buy acid from him. And I told him my theory of, well, not just my theory, but people who were in the family talking about this acid that he was giving. And he was like, yeah, you know, he never took Manson's acid. He used to take acid and go walk to the Theosophical Society library and just read all day on acid. But he was saying that, people, you could see that there was something else going on there with the acid that wasn't like what other people were experiencing prior with LSD. When you have LSD 25 and whatnot, people are like, it doesn't carry the same kind of dark energy. Like, I mean, that's one of those things. Like, you're like, wow, look how great Woodstock turned out. Everyone's having a great time. Right. Don't eat the brown acid, you know, which is STP. And then you have everyone at Altamont fucking going shit crazy, batshit crazy, and it's like, huh, I wonder what that's about, you know. Different acid.
Yeah, that's nuts. I read Pete Townsend's account of taking STP on a plane with Keith Moon, and it's just like a life-changing experience, even for Pete Townsend to take something that isn't of what he has been used to. Like, to say that you're used to the LSD experience is just kind of insane.
Right. So this ties right into something. Like, so yesterday I'm watching American Beauty with the commentary from Sam Mendes and the writer. And Alan Ball, okay. And they're talking about Pete Townshend and how basically there's a special thanks at the end of American Beauty to Pete Townshend and Dr. Bill and Alice. Dr. Bill and Alice, Eyes Wide Shut. He gives a shout out to fucking the characters from Eyes Wide Shut in the credits of American Beauty. It's like, well, what's true about both of those people? You know, that's, first of all, it's American Beauty. It's centered around the Rose. American Beauty, Grateful Dead, the Rose. It's called American Beauty, right?
I like this.
Townshend comes out with Tommy, which is a Rosicrucian film. The symbolism is so direct. He's looking around with a cube on his head. He sees Rosicrucian crosses all in front of, like at the grave and in the, like, everywhere. Like, it's just like, it is a straight up Rosicrucian film, which is the thing about you turn inward, because the rose is at the center of the cube of space, which when unfolded becomes the cross. And so the cross and the rose and Rosicrucianism is also emphasized with Rosemary's Baby. So this whole thing of basically what is essential is beyond the form, but it's through the turning inward and this whole thing. And so, you know, I mean, that's at least how I can't help but relate to it.
Well, so let me just add a little anecdotal story from today. So today I'm talking with Alan Green about all the stuff we're talking about now, because I'm just calling and saying, oh, did you know this about Rosemary's Baby and White Album, blah, 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 blah. And then today he calls me and he's on the street, call me back. We're just going back and forth. And he says, oh my God, it's October 9th. And guess who's going to be at Barnes & Noble? And the first thing I think is, wait a second, October 9th, it's John Lennon's birthday. Holy shit, we're doing this talk on John Lennon's birthday. That's amazing. Oh. And then he says, it's Pete Townsend. And I'm like, what? And he's like, yeah, Pete Townsend is going to be doing a signing books here at 7 o'clock. And I was like, well, you got to go. And he's like, and so he's going. So he's waiting. He got a book and he's waiting in line. And 7 o'clock for him was 4 o'clock when we started. So it's just so funny that I wasn't going to bring up the Townsend thing, but that this naturally got there.
And also, whose birthday is it today? John Entwistle, who is Boris the Spider. So we're back in the USSR.
Oh, wow. And then Peter, and Peter is actually the disciple of C.E. who's also have Peter and Paul, right? That's weird. Just saying.
What's that clinking?
I don't know.
Oh, that's my key, sorry. I'm just trying to shoehorn
And what is John Entwistle's nickname?
To crash into this, but not having a good time.
He's also known as the Ox. So the Ox would be the Aleph, wouldn't it? Don't really know how that connects, but it's something.
Well, the Ox, I mean, I guess it brings us back to, let's, I mean, I want to keep bringing it back to Rosemary's Baby and just sort of flowing with the song, with the album and what's happening in each scene. Because I'm running it as we're having this talk. So Rosemary's been impregnated by the beast and she wakes up to after birthday to,
as we're talking about birthdays,
yes, we talk to your blues.
Can right. I just say one know. Thing real quick though?
So lonely, gonna die.
In right, birthday, right, right. It says, you say it's your birthday, it's my birthday too, right? In Through the Looking Glass, a Humpty Dumpty is celebrating his unbirthday. So everybody has the same unbirthday, right? And right. What is happening to poor little Rosemary in the basement or wherever the hell she is? A lot of Humpty Dumpty going on inside that that womb of hers, right?
Actually, that's really perfect because you have, okay, he's the Eggman.
And he's breaking the egg.
Why is John Lennon the Eggman? For a while, I thought it was just because the Eggman gets laid and then it's a joke. So the most likely explanation, the most agreed upon, is that it's a reference to Salvador Dali's Eggman painting, which John Lennon was a huge fan of Salvador Dali, which is why he had the white piano, which he recorded Imagine on. So you have this, the Eggman, the cosmic man emerging from the egg, if you guys are familiar. And so you have Humpty Dumpty is actually a reference to King George, who went insane, right? And then you have, obviously, Humpty Dumpty and Alice in Wonderland, right? There's the whole thing with, how does that work in the book? I forget. It's not in the Disney version, but...
Also, just back to birthday, that's also, I think, the first appearance of Yoko singing.
Well,
vocals.
Okay. So here's the weird thing about the recording of Birthday, is that it was a song that was just made up on the spot between John and Paul. And it took them all night, you know, just a long studio session of starting it, crafting it together. But in the middle of the session, they watched a movie from 1956 called The Girl Can't Help It. So
with Jane Mansfield, who was in a car crash and lost her head.
Actually, Yoko Ono was with supporting vocals in the continuing story of Buffalo Bill. And
Bungalow.
Birthday is actually McCartney and Lennon together.
No, but isn't that Birthday? I think that's...
she joining in there? I don't know.
Yeah, I think her...
It doesn't say that on Wikipedia, but Wikipedia doesn't always have everything, so whatever.
All right, can we take a five minute break to smoke or take a leak or whatever, and then finish with the second half of this album? Sound like a plan, okay. Or?
I'm down.
Down? All right, back in five.